Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Conversation with the Mutual Fund Observer. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Please note that today's event is being recorded. This time, I'd like to turn the conference call over to Mr. David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. Hi, everybody. And welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer's conversation with Andrew Foster, manager of the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund. This is one of a series of calls designed first to allow our readers to hear a reflection on a fund genesis and strategy directly from its manager, and second, to give you a chance to raise questions in person. So here's our plan. We want to devote about the first third of our hour together to an intro to the fund, the middle third to my chat with Andrew, and the final third to your questions. I should note that the Observer has no financial ties with Seafarer. As a matter of fuller disclosure, I do have a personal investment in three Asia-centered funds, Andrew's former charge, Matthew's Asia Growth and Income, in Seafarer, and in Matthew's Asia Strategic Income Fund. By way of intro, I'll note that Andrew's career in emerging markets predates his investing career by a couple years. He began as a Singapore-based management consultant in 1996. In 1998, he joined Matthews International Capital Management, the folks who advised the Matthews Asia funds, and he served them as an analyst, as director of research, as acting chief investment officer, with the dubious fortune of assuming that post in the middle of a global financial crisis. While he's renowned for his management of Matthews Asia, Asian Growth and Income, it's less recognized that he launched and managed both their India and Asian dividend funds. He was eventually directly responsible for about $4 billion in emerging market assets. He left Matthews in March of 2011, and Seafarer launched just under a year later. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, David. Thanks. And I wanted to say thank you to the Mutual Fund Observer for hosting this call, and David, for you putting all your energy and effort to organizing this forum. I don't know how you do it. Alongside your day job, you must have a night job and never get any sleep in between. I also want to thank the audience for joining us today, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you all. I thought this call would serve as a good opportunity for me to discuss my background a little bit, which is effectively Seafarer's story, and to convey to this audience some of the same thoughts that I do when I sit down with some of the prospective clients or existing clients that are interested in the Seafarer Fund. Tell a little bit about that story that you don't hear so much. And the first question that most folks wonder about is really why I chose to leave my former employer that David mentioned, where I seemed to have a good thing going at a respected and large and growing firm. And the answer is that it was a very personal decision for me, and it wasn't an easy one to make at all, but it was absolutely the right one for me as an individual. I suppose that unlike other famous money managers, I'm not a famous one, but like some others out there that are famous that have left their ex-employers in a big huff and had legal battles and whatnot following, I hold my former employer in very high regard, and I retain some friendships there today that I'm very fortunate to do. But I found that it was really the right time for me to move on and undertake a new challenge, and there were two important catalysts acting on that decision that I want to discuss. The first catalyst is one that I would describe as being external. Early in my career, which David mentioned began in the mid-90s and more or less intersected with the height of the Asian financial crisis, I somehow decided that despite Asia's woes at that time, that China was the most underrated investment destination on the entire planet. I felt like it was a big and large and growing country that people were generally ignoring in their portfolios and otherwise, and I really wanted to participate in its evolution and growth and tie my career to it, and so much so that I really focused on trying to do everything that I could associated with Asia. That, as David mentioned, that meant working in the Asian region for a while and then eventually joining an Asia-dedicated investment firm. I was fortunate enough to help build that firm and to watch it grow over time, and even though the Asian markets were shaken violently several times along the way, I was pleased to see that Asia and China, in specific, fulfilled much of the potential that I'd hoped they would some years before. However, in late 2009, when many folks were singing China's praises for its ability to sidestep much of the 2008 global financial crisis, I noticed something in my own research that I had not seen before, and that was that China was slowing, not just cyclically, but structurally. When I had started my career, China had really suffered from a deficit of investment capital, but fast-forwarding to 2009, from that deficit of investment capital were all sorts of problems that stemmed, particularly the society was structurally unproductive and had a lot of challenges to overcome, and it was centrally planned. Fast-forwarding to 2009, many of those deficits had been overcome, and in fact, the deficit of capital that was so instrumental to China's early days and its early poverty had been overcome to the point where China had a surplus of capital and was perhaps struggling to reinvest it in the same fashion that it had done before. And what I felt was that the underlying fundamentals that had propelled China's growth so steadily for the prior two decades were slowly petering out, and there were no immediate or easy solutions to sustain its growth. I want to stress that I was not in the camp of folks that stubbornly insist that all things in China are a charade ready to collapse. Instead, I felt sort of lonely because I was somewhere in the middle. I could see that China was slowing, but it wasn't going to fall off a cliff. One thing I did know is that the country would never be the same, and it wouldn't be the sort of China that had grown monotonically for the past decade and around which so many investors and strategists had built their growth portfolios and the concept of the BRICS. This realization was striking enough for me to pause and really rethink my career, and it was a moment of intense reflection. And in the process, I ended up looking around a lot more. I started looking at markets that had never really figured much in my own analysis, portfolio-wise or career-wise. And I began to get excited about what I saw. I started to see other markets like Poland and Turkey and Mexico and Chile and Brazil. And I saw that the sort of changes taking place in those markets, the emergence of the household sector, the growing spending power of consumers, and the rise of the service sector, the retreat of the centrally planned economies in those countries, those were all familiar themes to me. And it really got me excited about moving beyond Asia and beyond this structural slowdown that I perceived in China. This led me to the second catalyst, which was a little bit more internal in nature. I realized as I was wanting to diversify beyond China within my career, I looked at options for launching a new strategy, a broader-based emerging market strategy, and that got me excited because I felt that I could take a strategy that had been well-tested in an Asian context, a growth and income strategy, which I'm going to discuss more in a moment, and introduce a broader version of it to the market for which I saw no obvious parallel from any major competitor. This was back in sort of the late 2010, 2011 period, and as I looked around and saw this, I didn't see anyone offering a similar sort of hopefully risk-adjusted sort of growth track record that would try and capture the broader promise of the emerging world. Ironically, since that moment, there's been a spate of launches in this category from a lot of very large firms, which I suppose validates some of the thinking that I had back then, but ironically gives Seafarer some competition, which is as it should be, and I'm excited to compete against what I would call the big boys. I also felt like I could bring a different sort of research and portfolio construction process to the table, one that would lead to a different approach than most others available in the market, so I was excited about that. And the third thing was that I felt that I had accumulated a lot of experience in investing in some very diverse countries across Asia. As David mentioned, I had launched and managed the India strategy for Matthews, and I had experiences in a wide gamut of markets spanning Japan and South Korea and Singapore to Indonesia and Thailand and Malaysia, and I felt like I could take some of this experience and map it to these other markets and find parallels or analogs in other markets around the world, especially markets that were maybe at an earlier stage of development or maybe at a similar stage of development as to what I had seen in Asia. And so far, that's really been the case. It's been one of the more exciting elements of the research we're doing at Seafarer. So when I had this excitement about launching a new fund, I looked at it in the context of my existing, my former employer, and I realized that firm really had a strategy in place, a growth trajectory, and it had a really intense focus on the Asian region that was really not compatible with what I wanted to do, which was to launch a new fund. from scratch and to take full responsibility for its outcome, and to take ownership of that outcome and to take pride in its steady development. And so this is what really motivated me to put a new flag in the ground, to start a new firm, and that new firm is Seafarer today. So turning to the strategy itself, I guess what I would say that makes it different from the other competitors that I mentioned a moment ago that have recently also launched in this sort of same category, and the category I mean by that is one that combines some growth and some income, that tries to achieve some risk-adjusted performance when focusing on the emerging world. I still think there are three things that we do a bit differently from the rest of the competition that I would highlight and would want you all to know about. The first is that we really do conduct our research from the bottom up and analyze each security on an individualized basis. We don't invest in top-down macro themes, and I'll explain that more in a moment. The second thing we do is we also construct portfolios in the same way. We really focus on building a concentrated portfolio comprised of individually selected securities versus some sort of top-down blend of asset classes or strategies. And the third thing we do is really focus on trying to achieve sustainable growth in the portfolio, even if that growth is sometimes slower than the sort of headline-grabbing, eye-popping growth rates that are associated with the emerging world. And then we take that more sustainable growth and we try to marry it with some current income. And we believe that provides more of a stable ride over time within the context of our portfolio. So to return to each of those three ideas and give a little bit more depth, the first is in discussing our bottom-up research process, what does that really mean? What I mean is that we spend all of our time really looking at individual companies and analyzing their individual fundamentals, that is to say their individual financial statements, their individual strategies, their individual operations and whatnot, and we weigh their unique merits. We don't invest based on macro trends or themes of the day or country analysis or sector analysis or these sorts of things. If we do have opinions in that regard, it's always the case that we digest those opinions in the context of an individual company. We would never make an investment in a theme and then find a company that fits that theme. It's always that we invest in the company. And if a theme happens to benefit a company, that's great, but the company has to bear the case out. The only macro work we do in earnest is to analyze the benchmark index that we are up against. It happens to be called the MSCI Emerging Market Index. We spend some time every now and again looking at that index intensively and understanding, or trying to understand at least, where we think it is poorly structured or where it might suffer from certain flaws that cause it not to reflect reality very well. When we identify those flaws, that's what helps prioritize our research work. It's effectively the case that if we find a country or a sector or an area of the market is being given short shrift by the index, and yet we have reason to believe that same country or sector is going to be an area where we see a great deal of growth in the future based on our bottom-up research work, well, that's obviously going to prioritize where we go looking for candidates for the portfolio. But what we don't do is spend a lot of time just trying to guess which country is going to surge forward this year, which central banker is going to cut interest rates, which currency is going to dive or rise or plunge, or necessarily the next sector bet is going to come from. I think these things are important to contemplate and have in the background, but they're really not what drive or motivate our day-to-day work here. So what we do is spend a lot of time analyzing the nature and quality of the cash flow of our individual companies. I'm going to discuss that a bit more in a moment. And also we spend a lot of time talking about the sustainability of the growth of those same companies. What we try and do is really get inside of the company, understand what makes it tick, understand how it makes its money, and understand the risks that are associated with that. It's critical we understand where there might be hiccups in the business model that might, under a certain set of scenarios, cause the cash flow to be interrupted, where the company might start making losses or have some other cash flow problem. And it's only by really getting into the meat of the business and the business model and understanding how it works both on paper and in reality that we can do this sort of work. We then complement that analysis with some time on the ground, seeing the companies firsthand. We think that this sometimes helps you avoid fraud. In my experience, it has happened a couple times that the on-site visits have revealed some real lemons, but frankly, it's really quite rare that that is actually the case. It's more so the case that you've spent some time at a distance analyzing a company, pulling together spreadsheets and financial statements and reading about it intensively. And even though you've done all that work, until you've been on the ground and seen how things work firsthand in person, it's almost assuredly the case you really don't understand how that business works in its entirety. So it's a moment where you get to really reflect on all that you've learned and tie it together in a coherent whole so that you can make a decision with respect to the portfolio to buy or sell or add more or add less. The other thing that it does is a little more nuanced, and it's perhaps something that's unique to Seafarer's research process, is that it helps us detect who's in charge of the company. A lot of people ask me what quality means in the context of an emerging market investment, and that's a very vague term anywhere it's applied. But a lot of people tend to associate this notion of quality and management. I find quality and management to be a very vague thing to search for. It's very hard to identify, and it's easy to get fooled by folks that use all the right buzzwords and jargon. What I tend to look for instead, that I think is usually an empirical exercise, is to try and determine who really owns a company, but especially who controls it. The control party may not be the obvious party at the table. It may be that someone owns a lot of the company, but a government minister holds a golden share that wields control over the company. Or it may be a family member that controls the company from a distance. Or it may be that the fact that both the family and the government have faded in the background and the professional managers are effectively stewards over the company and they call the shots. It's very hard to determine this until you're on site and you actually see how the company's configured and who's controlling it. And once you learn that, you really understand the trajectory that the company's on, because you can then begin to model in an understanding of what the control party is trying to do with the company and whether or not it's at odds with your goals as a minority investor in that company. Unfortunately, the emerging world doesn't have the same sort of legal protections and other protections that are afforded small investors in large companies, and you're very easily abused by a bad control party. So what I look for is control parties that are at least not causing damage to your company, and hopefully they respect minority shareholders' rights. So the second thing we do that's different, I think, from the field is that we really focus on bottom-up portfolio construction. And what I mean by that is that one person, me, individually selects and weighs and balances each and every security in the portfolio against every other. This may seem like a fairly straightforward idea, and I imagine that about 99% of the people on this call do exactly that with their own personal portfolios. But the irony is that when you move into the world of institutional investment, things often get far more complicated, but often without any real discernible benefit. Professional managers tend to develop, say, macro strategies, and then they layer across them asset classes, and then within those asset classes they have strategic sleeves, and within those sleeves they have specialist analysts that pick stocks from a very narrow field of view over which they have incredible expertise but maybe not very much breadth. Trying to marry all of that into a coherent whole is a really tricky thing to do. It sounds very elegant on paper, but I think it's hard to make it work in practice because you get a lot of cross-interference mapping those strategies on top of asset classes, on top of strategic sleeves, on top of stock picks. And even if you can do all that, you tend to suffer from two problems. You tend to get a lot of indecisiveness creeping into the process because you're really not sure who's responsible for the decision at the end of the day that causes certain security inside of the portfolio to be inside of the portfolio, because you've had so many layers of decision making. And the second thing you have is you tend to have a lot of politics creep into the process because you get a lot of people saying, hey, that wasn't my fault that security wound up there. I personally prefer perhaps the less elegant but far more practical approach of just having one small, tight-knit team that communicates with each other in a very integrated and intensive fashion without a lot of layers or hierarchy, and you have one person at the top that is hopefully immensely afraid of failure and doing everything to motivate themselves against failure, not necessarily trying to hog the limelight for success, but to avoid failure. And that person is in charge of picking the securities on an integrated basis. And weighing the respective merits of those securities against each other. Are there some pros and cons to this process? Sure. first you, but I would say the pros really outweigh the cons. And the first thing I would say is that it forces me to know each security individually, its risks, its opportunities, and my expectations for its performance firsthand. And therefore, I'm able to make a finer assessment of it and its worth versus every other security in the portfolio, and therefore what its weight should be. The second thing is it helps me make faster decisions over when something's either gone well or gone wrongly. I'm able to assess that real time versus have to wait for my underlying specialist analyst in a given sector to report back to me. And the third thing is that it helps me take bigger positions in general and be more concentrated in decision making. I have to admit I always wonder about so-called active portfolios that have more than 100 positions in them. Sometimes these are truly active portfolios, but I tend to think this is really a sign of a bifurcated and fragmented decision-making process. I personally think that concentration is a luxury of focus, and it's that sort of focus that helps outperformance over long periods of time. The third and final thing that I think that makes us different from the rest of the emerging market players out there is that we really are focused on sustainable growth. And then we try and marry that's the obvious reason to invest in the emerging world, but we try and marry that with current income because we have the aim of trying to find growth that's sustainable and steady and less subject to the volatility that's so intrinsic to the developing world. We think that current income is an important means to achieving that end. What we're looking for, first and foremost, is sustainable growth, and what I mean by that is avoiding investments that are driven by one-off events, or catalysts or concepts, things that will maybe cause a big spurt in growth but then peter out. I also try and avoid companies that derive their economic value from government subsidies or protections or special kinds of influences because you never know when the political master may change and that company may fall out of favor. So this, I think, by looking for more sustainable sources of growth, it often actually pushes us into companies that are often deemed mature within the context of the emerging world, companies that have been through business cycles before and are a bit more seasoned. That ironically means a bit slower growth in some cases, but I'm perfectly okay with that because I deem that growth to be more sustainable. And I often, ironically, can buy that growth at a cheaper valuation most of the time. Ultimately, what I'm trying to do is search for real and lasting progress in the developing world. We're obviously investing in a part of the world that is far from perfect or formed. And what we're trying to do is identify situations that are constantly improving and getting better. Not that they're starting from a great state. Transparency and accounting in China is terrible in many cases, but it's getting better all the time. And it's that change that motivates markets. It's that change that begets social progress. And I think some of that progress spills over to something that we know is corporate profits. And it spills over in a lot of different directions, but it ultimately shows up in profits if a company is really creating social value. And that's what I'm trying to capture in the portfolio. I marry this growth with current income because I think it does three important things for investors. Not because I value the income in its own right, but because I think it does three things. Those three things are that it provides a crucial check on the quality of a business model. I ask myself, is this company producing liquid cash that it can pay out to me as an investor, or is it generating high-flying paper earnings that are only based in accounting standards, not in cash reality? I know that from experience that volatility will eventually come to test each and every market in which I invest. And if the company is not producing liquid cash flow, it may not survive. Its liquidity and solvency will be tested, and survival is paramount. I've often seen that survivors through the tough parts of the cycle get the benefit of consolidating their markets after the fact, and they enjoy a spurt of growth as a consequence. So survival is paramount if a company is really going to capture its long-term growth potential. And you don't do that with you don't have companies survive if they're generating only paper profits. So having them pay out a portion of that proves to me that that value is real. The second thing is that it provides a common valuation metric across all these different countries in which I invest. There's so many different accounting standards and levels of transparency, some quite good, some quite poor. But at least current income is something that I can focus in on, hone in on, and use as a standard yardstick to measure the worth of companies. In fact, we have a standardized proprietary model to measure a company's ability to produce growing income. And this helps us at least orient our portfolio in a central way. Lastly, I really believe that current income provides a buffer in volatile markets. If you've done your homework and you proved out that the income is going to be sustainable even in the tough times, that the dividends are going to get paid even when the chips are down, then I think it provides you some downside protection. It's like a sea anchor. If you're out at sea and things get rough, you throw your anchor overboard. It doesn't catch right away, but it does start to drag, and it slows down the extent to which your ship is swinging around. In like fashion, if you've done your homework on your portfolio and it generates enough current income, then as markets fall, your portfolio tends to fall less rapidly. Is it immune? No, but it is declining at a less rapid rate. And eventually, like a sea anchor, it comes to a hold sooner. That anchor grips the bottom of the ocean floor and stops your ship from swinging around. And likewise, you tend to find that in the emerging markets, at least, that a portfolio with solid current income comes to rest sooner and doesn't experience the true depths of a sharp market downturn the way that a portfolio of common stocks without a focus on income would do. So that's really what we do that I hope is different, and I hope that gives you some background on why I launched the fund and how we do things differently. And with that, I'm ready to chat further, David.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. That's very kind. It was also very clear. My plan, for what it's worth, is to chat with you for 10 minutes or so and then see if folks on the line have questions of their own. Partly what I wanted to do was to kind of pass along questions folks had raised on our discussion board. And the first of those is driven kind of by meditations about, you know, the sort of new normal, right? The world that most of us grew up in was sort of centered on the United States. And so you thought about investing in the U.S. as the safe and sensible thing to do. It was the equivalent of the broccoli on your plate. And then there was all this other stuff that you could put your crazy money into, the emerging markets kind of among them. But I'm not sure that's true anymore. There is certainly a wealth of evidence that says that, you know, the drivers of global growth are located outside of the developed world. And some of my readers were sort of wondering how that should lead them to think about the role of emerging markets in their own portfolio. I mean, is this still a small slice of a long-term investor's larger portfolio, or how do they think of that when it comes down to whether they're going to invest in Ford or Tata Motors or whatever?
Well, I think that I try to be very definitive about my opinions on things, David, but this is one I have to sit on the fence a little bit about.
Mm-hmm.
I very much believe that the growth that we're seeing in the emerging world is an important driver of the future. I do think we're going to see more of the world's growth emanate from the developing countries of the world, and I do think investors really do need to think about greater exposure to their portfolio than they have done perhaps in the past, and broad exposure at that. So I don't think this is a gimmicky sort of short-term trend. Obviously, I've tied my career to it, and I'm very biased in that regard, but I really think this is – everything I see suggests this is the real deal.
Right.
It is not sort of an esoteric asset class. The problem is that this is not going to happen in a straight line, and there's going to be a lot of volatility along the way. And I think the real flashpoint for that volatility has been and likely will remain – the currencies of the emerging world. A lot of folks are very excited about their potential, say, versus the dollar or other major global currencies like the euro. And I'm not here to extol either of those two developed world countries, but or currencies, excuse me. But the problem is that the emerging market currencies aren't necessarily ready for prime time either. They are making almost all the right moves in most of the major emerging markets to make their currencies more stable, more deep, and more liquid. So the news and the trend is good. But the problem is, as we've seen from the Eurozone crisis, even big, mature markets that supposedly have a good grasp on how to manage their currencies can get in a lot of trouble. And I would say that a lot of these smaller markets absorb an enormous amount of economic pressure through their currencies. And when things are going well, it seems like it's great. But when things are going badly and the chips are down, those currencies can suffer a sharp reversal. So for your audience, I would say, if you have large dollar-denominated liabilities like mortgage payments or college payments you've got to make for your kids or retirement needs or whatever that are denominated in dollars, you need to keep most of your portfolio balanced against that. And I wouldn't expect that it would be a good idea to make to undertake a big currency mismatch between your assets, say investing very aggressively in the emerging world, versus maybe in a hope to escape dollar weakness, and yet have to deal with the liabilities that we all eventually know are going to come due. So watch out for that risk within your portfolio. But otherwise, I think the long-term growth story is there.
Okay. And are there places in the emerging world, as we think about the universe of emerging market funds, are there places that Seafarer doesn't go? That is, if folks were wondering about how they would get that emerging market exposure, do you think, are you comfortable with Seafarer being sort of an all-in-one solution, or?
You know, I hope to make Seafarer a broad fund that serves a lot of folks' investment needs for the emerging world, but obviously I wouldn't want to lay claim to being a one-size-fits-all. I think the good news about the emerging world is its depth and liquidity and growth has been broadening, and that means that different types of strategies can have a real purchase in the emerging world in a way that, you know, people only turn to the emerging world for growth in the past. I don't think it's impossible you would seek a value fund or a deep value fund or a growth and income fund or all different sorts of strategies that you would normally associate with a developed market like the U.S. I think you'll see that strategic bifurcation grow. As far as where we won't go, there's a simple answer to that. No, I won't go anywhere where I won't put my own team on the ground or myself on the ground because of personal safety. If I can't put my boots on the ground, then I'm not going to put shareholders' capital there. We in the early days of Seafarer, we saw a marvelous company based in Egypt that was surviving against all odds and doing quite well, and it was incredibly cheap, and we continue to watch it. But right now, frankly, none of us really want to get on a plane and go to Egypt. So we're not investing there, full stop.
Well, that's something I hadn't considered, but it does strike me as awfully sensible, all things considered. You know, you've been identified over time, Andrew, for your willingness to invest in securities other than common stocks, at least in part in pursuit of income. Right now, Seafarer has a fairly modest exposure to equities, to securities other than common stocks. It looks like 10% of the fund or so are in preferred or convertible shares. Depending on how you view your property holdings, I guess it could go up to 15. I was wondering if you could talk to us a bit about the future of, or the way you think about, non-equity securities.
Well, I think, as I mentioned, the good news about these markets is they are growing in their depth and liquidity, and so there are other asset classes really emerging out of the developing world. I think fixed income instruments are really growing in Asia and elsewhere in a way that I think you've noted in the past in some of your other calls, David. And I think that's an important, incredibly important development that will help bring greater stability to these markets over time. And that really opens up the possibilities for a portfolio like the Seafarer Fund to invest across different elements of companies' capital structure or across the asset classes. It's across asset classes. I would say that my own research process, my own investment style, is really focused on companies and trying to capture sustainable growth. And I orient myself first with issuers, the companies that actually issue the stocks or the bonds. And I try and assess their quality on a lot of different dimensions and their growth prospects and their valuation. And it's only after I've done that I make a tactical decision about, do I want to own a stock from this company or a bond from this company or preferred equity from this company? And so it's really a subsidiary tactical decision about how best to approach a particular issuer rather than the sort of top-down decision that I want to be 60% in bonds. And therefore, I'm going to, you know, reallocate the portfolio there. So it really is a bottom-up process in that regard. Now, if I have a sense that most equities are overvalued, in the back of my head, am I going to be looking a lot more closely at the fixed income instruments that those that the issuers that I favor might offer? I certainly will. Right now, I have to say that I'm concerned about fixed income valuations the world over right now. I think a lot of people are concerned about U.S. valuations, but I would say that the spreads in the emerging world don't leave a whole lot of room for error. And the only way that I think U.S. investors can be sure that they'll come out well is if the U.S. dollar really declines versus those currencies, and I don't know that that's all necessarily going to occur. So I think basically you have to really be certain of some sort of currency appreciation to be sure that you'll get risk-adjusted returns. I think it's an important area to pay attention to, and I hold out a lot of hope for the fixed income markets in emerging world, but I'm nervous.
Okay, well that strikes me as fairly serious. Jamie, are you still there, buddy?
Yes, sir.
So here's my thought. I'd like to ask Andrew one more question and then open up the lines for questions from folks who've been listening in. Could you give them the talk on how they would queue up for a question, and then I'll go back to Andrew?
Absolutely. If you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one using a touchtone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, we do ask that you please pick up your handset before pressing the keys to ensure good sound quality. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two. Again, it is star and then one to join the question queue.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. Andrew, I had a few more questions, but what I thought I would do is ask just one more and then turn it over to the folks. If they're being quiet, I'll go back to kind of my list. Seafarers had very low turnover in its first year. One of the things that I think is really neat, I had been looking at some of the data you had provided, and one of the things you noted was what contributed either positively or negatively to the fund's net asset value, and brokerage costs, as it turns out, cost you about a penny a quarter in terms of the fund's NAV. And I don't think I've ever seen a fund actually talk about, the cost of turnover that way. But in any case, it's been a fairly low turnover strategy. Andre, who I suspect is listening quietly in the background now, was wondering how you would talk about the tax efficiency of the fund. He's owned one of the Asian dividend funds, and it struck him as not being terribly tax efficient, so he kind of stuck it in an IRA, and he didn't know, as he thought about Seafarer, whether you imagined it would be a relatively efficient or a product, or one that is better off in an IRA or somewhere similar.
Yeah, I'm not sure which. I'd probably be reluctant to say what sort of account or approach one should take to holding it, because it's going to vary for everyone's individual circumstance. But I would say that the fund isn't. Unfortunately, I can't say that I don't intentionally manage the fund for tax efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very marginal thing that I try and do at the when looking at which securities to own. Occasionally, I can invest in a company from the same, or excuse me, a security from the same company, maybe one that's listed in the U.S. that gets a preferred tax status. At least until recently, ADRs. The dividends that came from ADRs generally got a better tax, or you were more certain of getting a better tax treatment on those dividends than you were than investing in some of the emerging markets directly. And so at the margin, when I can own an ADR in that instance, I almost assuredly will. So there's small things I do, but I would not hold this fund out as being deliberately tax efficient.
Okay. Do you imagine that the turnover that we're seeing in the portfolio in its first year is pretty typical of how you imagine it going forward, or do you have, because that's going to be part of the efficiency equation, is harvesting gains in the portfolio?
Yeah, I hope so. I think my I think historically I've managed, in some of the portfolios I've managed in the past, I've kept the turnover to fairly low levels, even during times of some fairly volatile market movements. I think Seafarer is aiming for the same sort of construct. We have We have bought and sold a few positions already, happily two of them because they were takeout targets from acquirers. But we've already exited a few positions for because concerns have arisen or we have found better opportunities elsewhere. And I say that reluctantly because it's sort of surprising to me that that's already happened within the first year. We hit our first year anniversary on Friday. But it happens, and that's what we're here to do. So we're trying to keep the turnover low, but it happens.
Okay, that's great. The yield on the portfolio now is something short of 2%, which would be the other one of the other factors that is involved in the tax efficiency, depending on how you measure it. 1.7 to 1.8 percent yield.
Yes, that's the SEC yield that you're talking about, David? Yeah, that's the SEC yield. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
That's a particular metric that measures, I think, I don't know the exact calculation myself, but it's it looks back over the income that's been generated by the portfolio over a fixed horizon historically. I think it's 30 or 90 days, I forget
30.
Which. 30 days, and then it measures it in that context. We think the portfolio's gross yield is a bit higher than that, a fair bit higher than that when we calculate the dividends we expect for the year ahead. But that's what's been produced over the last 30 days.
Great. Jamie, do we have questions waiting?
We do. We have a question from Richard Falk. Please go ahead with your question.
Thanks for putting this on tonight. My question deals with capacity. And what I mean is you talk about some bigger institutions getting involved in this space that's going to have a lot more marketing power and so forth. And so I'm kind of curious on the bottom end how much you need in terms of assets to make this a successful ongoing type of fund. And then on the flip side, if you're going to be very hands-on in selecting individual securities, how much capacity you can have on the upper end?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think on the lower end, we've always wanted to get this strategy above $100 million before it could really have really stronger economics, hopefully reflected in lower expenses to shareholders over time. There's a kind of a duality of that question, which is how big does Seafarer, the company, need to be to survive? And we're making good progress to that goal because we are growing in some ways outside of this fund, which we're excited about. So I think our viability as a company is very exciting at this moment. I think the fund is making good progress towards that scale. It's about a little over $35 million today, which is frankly more than I thought we would have after our first year in existence. So on Seafarer's overall growth as well as that of the fund, I'm pretty excited about where we're going, even though we have a ways to go to get across that threshold. I think in terms of long-term capacity, it's a bit of a moving target. I don't want to be too vague about it. It really depends on market conditions and the liquidity we're experiencing in our holdings. But I have in mind that we would one day hope to be able to grow the strategy at least to $1 billion. I know that sounds strange when it's as small as it is right now, but I've managed strategies that were very similar, in fact, in narrower markets in Asia that were many times that size. So I'm excited to grow the strategy to at least that sort of threshold. Beyond that, I would be very cautious about how much further we grow. We take every incremental step as it came.
Great. Jamie, other questions, Bud?
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one using a touch-tone telephone. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two.
Are there other folks in the queue?
I am not showing any questions at this time.
Well, that's silly of them. I was wondering, Andrew, a question from one of the readers, Teapot, was that many of the countries in Asia in particular have export-oriented economies. With Japan starting to devalue its currency, is that going to hurt the kind of attractiveness of the region as a whole? What does it do for you?
What an interesting question. I think some of the work that I did for my former employer when I first got there was to try and look at some of the contributing causes to the Asian crisis in 97-98. And I, there are a lot of there are libraries written on the topic. But one of the least heralded contributing causes to the crisis back then was the fact that the yen weakened very appreciably between 94, the middle of 94, and the middle of 97 when the Asian crisis really kicked off. And during that period, most of the Asian currencies were either fixed against the U.S. dollar and therefore suffering sort of a competitive erosion versus the yen, and also many of them were experiencing high rates of domestic inflation, such that their competitiveness was eroding in that regard as well. And so it was sort of a double whammy that the yen suddenly became much weaker. And I think most people don't talk about it. They talk about crony capitalism and bad banks and all sorts of things. And I think those are all part of the equation. But this is one that gets short shrift. And here we are again. The yen has weakened very sharply. Now, admittedly, it's weakened from very, very, very high levels.
Right.
And the weakening that's occurred has really not been that dramatic in the bigger arc of modern history. But it's definitely worth paying attention to. What's happening in Japan right now is very much worth paying attention to. The shock that Japan experienced with the earthquake and the tsunami, and 2 decades of really caustic in operating conditions for many companies has brought a lot of change. I don't think anyone can look at Japan with stars in their eyes, but I also would say that everyone should watch what's happening in that economy, because I think this is the first time I've seen it changing at this sort of pace in my career, except maybe a little bit under Koizumi it was similar. But they're really shaking things up, and I think there's some change that may bring some change for the better in the Japanese case. So I pay attention. In terms of the current portfolio, I don't think it's had any immediate impact on the Seafarer Fund. I've watched a few of my somewhat more export-oriented companies be beaten up at the margin. I assume it's a little bit because of this impact. There may be other effects at work. But that's been my thinking. So I think this yen movement is having consequences. It hasn't stirred great portfolio reallocation on my part, but I am going to Japan in a few weeks' time to see things on the ground myself, because we have exposure there in the fund, and we want to keep investing.
Okay. The weakening currency is not a serious problem then for the economies in the region just yet?
Well, I think it isn't yet, but I do think that Japan trying to re-stimulate and reinvigorate its economy is worth everyone's attention, because it does strike me that this is for real, and that that there is enough of a tier of Japan that is ready to respond to this change that it may be different than from some of the false starts in the past. Could be another false start. I could be wrong about this, but it looks and feels very different.
Cool. Other questions, Jamie?
We do have a question from Joe Naylor. Please go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, and thank you, David, for putting this on once again. Excellent opportunity for all of us. My question is, you mentioned that the problems that an investor whose assets and liabilities are tied to the U.S. currency would have with a lot of exposure to foreign currency earnings. And I guess my question is, has the fund ever thought about hedging some of those foreign currency exposures, number one? Would you undertake that? And I guess, two, how exposed really is the fund?
Currently, the fund has nearly about 97% invested, and all that investment is in foreign securities. No, that's not true. We have $1-denominated bond in the portfolio at present. That's of a major weighting, but it basically the fund is in foreign-denominated securities. As far as currency hedging goes, we definitely entertain the possibility within the fund's prospectus. It's not something I seek to roll out in practice, mainly because I don't think I have a strong ability to predict currencies in a way that I can hedge effectively. Hedging is enormously hard to do in a cost-efficient fashion, and I really think it tends to be to investors' detriment. I look at currencies this way. I see them as being married to the underlying investment themselves, and I don't. Financial theory says you can say you can buy a stock but hedge away the currency exposure. I think they go together part and parcel. It's like buying a house in a neighborhood and then somehow selling short the ground underneath the house, saying I love the house but I don't like the neighborhood. I think they go together. And if you somehow manage to hedge out your exposure to the neighborhood, you might be able to do so for a short while, but if the neighborhood's sinking, so too will you over time. So what I try and do is stay clear of those currencies altogether that I think are going to be really problematic. That's not to say that I'll be right about it, but if I do detect that there's some problem in a currency, I'll at least try and find issuers that will benefit from currency weakness as much as those that will benefit from its strength, that will have assets that will reprice in the new environment. It's been really notable in Japan. We were talking about a moment ago. There have been a lot of stocks that have risen lockstep with the yen's weakness, so that if you were a dollar-based investor, your investment would have been at least flat in dollar terms, because even as the yen was declining and eroding your return, the assets were appreciating one for one, and I don't think that's coincidence in a globally connected set of financial markets. The market was repricing those assets. So those are the kinds of positions you need to look out for if you think currency weakness is ahead, or avoid the currency altogether. You're not gonna make money if the currency is going down in flames and you hedge out. You try and invest in a smart idea and the currency blows up on you.
Great. Other questions, Jamie?
Our next question comes from Ellie Tabbitt. Please go ahead with your question.
I just have a question about the expense ratio and how long it will stay at these levels. Thanks.
Yeah. We recently had the pleasure of reducing the expenses of the fund. We started off with expenses of 1.6% and 1.45% on the investor and institutional share classes, respectively. Those fund expenses were capped by CFARER. We're now down to 1.4% and 1.25% on those two share classes, respectively. We did so via a voluntary waiver that we rolled out on the 15th of January. And what that means, there's a lot of lingo about that in our prospectus, but what that means is this was a quick decision we could make in CFARER's offices to immediately reduce expenses without engaging in another contract keep them lower for a fixed period of time. When you do a contractual waiver, you've got to meet with the fund's board and you've got to adhere to that waiver for a specific period of time, and that's time-consuming and costly. So what we did is we pledged to reduce them until the next contractual period was over, which is this August. That coincides with the prospectus's renewal. And at this moment, we have every intention to then roll these new expense ratios into new contractual obligations. And over time, we hope to continue to do better still. It's very, very important to me to make investment in the emerging world affordable for investors. One of the most difficult things about starting up on my own, if I had a regret, frankly, it's the fact that I could leave a firm where I was able to manage money for clients at a fairly low rate of cost, and because of my small scale at CFARER, had to introduce a higher expense ratio. And that was frustrating, to say the least. But that is the economic reality.
Great. Other questions, Jamie?
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one.
I'll take that as a no for the moment. I'll ask one final question. We'll check in with Jamie and then have to wrap up. I had noticed in looking at the portfolio, Andrew, that over time your exposure to smaller companies seems to have been cut in about half. A year ago, say, about a quarter of the portfolio was in small-cap names, and now it's about 12%. I didn't know if that was because of the growing attractiveness of the large companies or the sort of deterioration of small.
So there were two or three things there going on at once. But yes, you're absolutely right about the trend, by the way, David, that you noticed. One is that we had some happy luck in some of our small caps. A few of them appreciated, they were just below the sort of dividing line between small cap and large cap, and they happened via appreciation to jump over that line. One of them in particular, as I mentioned before, we had a couple two portfolio candidates bought out in via acquisition. One of them was one of our bigger small cap holdings, so it went away. But we've had a few of them sort of vault over into mid-cap land, and that has caused that to swell up. But the bigger thing that I would highlight is actually we have moved a bit out of the small and the mid into the larger cap, and it's because I started to perceive in December last year, November, that markets had definitely picked up off the lows that we saw last June, last May and June. Without a whole lot of fundamental change underneath them. I felt that valuations were really attractive last May and June. By the end of the year, they were not by any means stretched, but they were just less attractive, and I felt that there was a little bit greater safety in some of the larger companies with lower valuations associated with them. I was wrong in the shortest run. The markets have continued to surge through sort of mid-January. They've gone a little bit sideways since, but... So my timing was a bit off in that regard, but I suppose you could say we've been trying to get a little more defensive. I said before that I was worried about fixed income, so that hasn't, you know, it's not that I think it's an impending disaster, but that hasn't been a place where I would turn to for safety at the margin. I actually find greater value and greater safety in regular old common equities that pay good dividends right now, for the most part. So... That's been driving that a little bit of that allocative shift.
Okay, great. A final question, Jamie?
We actually have a few that have joined. Andre Lind has a question. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi. First of all, my question was already formulated by David, but I just would like to reformulate it slightly. When I'm looking at Matthew's dividend, its dividend is about 4% almost, and your dividend right now is about 2%, so it looks like it is going to be a bit more tax efficient, or is it just a temporary state of your fund? That is the first question. And the second, I know that some value managers, like from Artisan Global and FPA International, they consider emerging market like more valued already than developed. Would you agree or not?
Andre, can you repeat the second question? I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand that.
Some of the value managers, like, for example, in the Artisan Global or FPA International Fund, they believe that emerging markets are overvalued and they have zero of them in their portfolio, and I wonder whether they agree with this position.
Okay, overvalued. Okay, to address your two questions, I think when you say that the dividend of the fund is 2%, I think you mean what I would call probably the distribution yield,
yep.
which is the distributions we've paid out divided by maybe our recent share price, and
yep.
That is around 2%, and that definitely goes to tax efficiency. I would say that this is a function of a growing fund. One thing I learned with my former employer and also again in the context of CFAIR, the way it works is you invest a certain amount of money and you get some dividends back from your holdings. And then if your fund is growing, the dividends from a particular company have already been paid. So you don't get to go back and ask for more dividends from that company, even though you might buy more shares from that company. So you've earned your current income for the year. But your denominator, the number of shareholders that are with you, is growing. And so when it comes time for me to pay those dividends out in the form of taxable income distributions, I'm sharing them amongst a much larger base. The fund has grown from $2 million or so at launch to about
mm-hmm.
$35 million. And so what we have is, in percentage terms, a very large growth in the denominator. But meanwhile, we've been earning dividends all throughout the year with varying amounts of capital at risk. And so as long as the fund is growing, then I think the distribution yield will be depressed versus maybe the sort of underlying forward-looking yield, if you will. The same is true opposite, by the way. If you have a fund that's shrinking and it's earned income throughout the year, and people are taking money out of that fund, the people that are still holding it at the end of the year might get a whopper of a distribution. But So that's the sort of mechanical aspects of running a fund. But we do have a higher dividend yield. So if the fund were stable in terms of its size, we think that the gross yield is about a little over 3.5%. Our expenses take away, depending on your share class, about an average of 1.5%. So that still gets you to about 2% in the short run. But we think the growth will influence that. On overvaluation, I totally disagree with these folks that don't see any reason to invest in the emerging world. I tend to think there's plenty of, if you're a real stock picker, these markets are broad and deep, and there's plenty of places to find attractive growth at a reasonable price. As I mentioned, I'm a little worried about the state of valuations overall. We're clearly off the lows that we saw in May and June. But the notion that there's nothing worth investing in is, I've always sort of scoffed at. I think it's people that aren't out there kicking the tires doing the homework. You know, I would confess that there's probably some real deep valuations in Europe at this moment, that if you really have faith that the Eurozone will make it through its crisis, there may be some bargains to snatch up there. But the notion that there's nothing in the emerging world is something that I think comes from, frankly, lack of real experience or maybe even ignorance of the markets. I hate to be so disparaging, but that's my own opinion.
The Artisan Global Fund is number one fund for the last 10 years in international, so it's hard to accuse them in not knowing what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think these markets are broad and deep. There's, you know, over 7,000 companies out there, and the notion that there's nothing worth owning is
right.
Something that comes from the idea that you're not paying attention to those 7,000 companies.
Right, and I think Andre's question was more just if you had to allocate capital between developed and developing markets, that some of the global managers think that the developed markets are on whole a little more compelling now, perhaps because of the Europe thing where they haven't had quite the success lately.
Well, you know, I guess I'm not enough of an asset allocator to really make those comparisons. Mm-hmm. I think it's well understood that the if you were to look at most basic measures of valuation between the developing and the developed world, the developing world is actually at a cheaper valuation overall. I think one could have some questions about the growth of the emerging world, and therefore the trade-off between growth and valuation may be less certain than maybe the U.S. economy, which seems to be healing pretty nicely right now. But I reject mm-hmm. firmly the notion that the emerging markets are overvalued. It just doesn't maybe undervalued, but with worrisome growth prospects. But the notion that they're overvalued doesn't ring true.
Okay, Jamie, anyone else, Bud, before we shut it down?
We have an additional question from Michael Weingarten. Please go ahead with your question.
Oh, thank you very much. I guess the question I had was just in terms of looking at valuation, if you're having difficulty finding good values in general, will you allow cash to build to a certain level within the fund, or are you, for the most part, trying to keep yourself fully invested, keep the fund fully invested?
Yeah, my goal is for the most part to keep the fund fully invested, and it's for some of the same reasons I mentioned. I have a really broad mandate to go into a number of different markets around the world, and I'm pretty confident that mandate's breadth will be great enough to help me to find growth that's worth investing in, provided that I have an adequate time horizon over which to realize that growth. I don't invest based on one-year outcomes. I'm looking at 3 years and typically even longer, 5 years, in terms of whether or not I assess an investment as being worth the risk. So I think in that sense, I have little capacity to say whether or not an investment will be better than cash will be better than a particular investment over the next year, but I don't put the money at risk unless I have confidence over that longer horizon, and I have the breadth to do that in terms of my mandate. So I'm lucky in that regard. I think the second thing is our expense ratios are high enough that it's really incumbent on me to make sure that the money is put to work and tries to earn something for shareholders over time. I think that does put folks in the difficult position of having to say, hey, I don't want to own this fund right now because he's fully invested, and at least over the next 3 or 6 months, I'm worried about emerging markets or whatever it might be. And I certainly understand that. And so what I try to do is communicate as clearly as possible via our firm's various communications, our shareholder letters, our website, et cetera, about what I see going on in markets so that people have at least a real sense of what I'm seeing. And if they want to dial back their exposure because they're worried about such risks, I certainly understand that. But I'm not going to use cash as a major tactical asset in the portfolio. I think compared to my old days at my former employer, we were all very disciplined about having very low levels of cash in the portfolios. And I think 2008 changed that a little bit, so I give myself a bit more room. I've been averaging, say, 3 to 5% cash levels, but not the kind that would provide a significant buffer in a time of distress.
Great. Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so I think you said this earlier, but I just want to make sure I understood what you were saying. But basically what you were saying is that even though the markets have moved up a fair amount over the last, 9 months now, you're still finding enough in the way of good values to continue to, pick up either increase positions or pick up new positions to keep the fund, fairly fully invested. Is that correct?
On a 3 to 5 year horizon, absolutely. What I've been trying to signal is that, valuations have moved up a good 30% or so from their lows, and the underlying health of the economies and the growth of these companies hasn't picked up 30%. It's not really even that much better than it was last summer, frankly. It's maybe a little bit better. And consequently, I'm just trying to point out to folks that valuations are up, the fundamentals are not that much better, markets are not the bargain they were over the summer. Be a little more careful. But I'm not trying to sound alarm bells over panic. But all this has to be taken with a grain of salt because I trying to predict where markets are going to be over the next 6 to 12 months is really, really not my forte. I am trying to invest in companies that I think will provide the kind of growth that the fund is seeking over the next 3 to 5 years, and that I'm confident we're finding those sort of opportunities right now.
Great.
Thank you so much.
We've run just a little over our hour, so I'd probably better take this time to thank Andrew and to all of you for your time tonight. Just so you know, a tape of this call and an audio profile of Seafarer will be available at The Observer on March 1st. And I wanted to also highlight three upcoming events. I'll be appearing as a guest on Chuck Jaffe's radio show, Money Life, to talk a bit more about Seafarer and the world of emerging markets investing. Second, tomorrow night, the good folks at River North are going to host a webinar on their new dynamic buy right fund, especially for folks who understand the options market, which, in truth, I'm a little fuzzy on. Folks who do understand it should navigate over to rivernorth.com. They'll allow you to sign in yet. And then finally, on Tuesday, March 5th, we'll kick off a 3-month examination of highly focused portfolios. And we'll be joined by Richard Cook and Dal Bynum of the Cook and Bynum Fund. We'll have more details in our March issue. And the special feature of that fund is I'm going to tie my son up so that he doesn't pick up the other phone and begin dialing friends partway through the call. He's a wild and crazy lad. Thank you all. Thank you especially, Andrew. I'm looking forward to speaking with you all again. Have a good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for attending today's conference. It has now concluded. You may now disconnect your telephone lines.